I feel like we have gone through something really harrowing together. We've read Murder on the Lynx.
We did. We did. We've read it. It's in my head now.
We have just undergone something, yet we are about to undergo a new challenge and endeavor, which is to talk about this book.
Yes, this is the debrief episode. Yeah. There are going to be a lot of spoilers right away. So if you haven't read the book and you don't want to know the spoilers,
stop
right now.
I feel like I need to issue an apology to our listeners. And that is, I feel like I recorded the pre-read from the sweet, sweet, naive place of having been about a third of the way through my reread when we recorded it. Mm-hmm. I would like to say, I will make sure I will never do this again to our listeners. I now know the error of my ways.
Yeah, when I was editing the pre-read episode, I felt that way too. And I was like, oh, we are making this sound like it's a jaunty walk through like a French park. And it's not.
You know what it reminds me of is there's this hike that my dad and I used to go on in the Cascades, Mount Dickerman. And it's this hike where you're going. And you know when you can like see the top of the hill in the horizon? And you're like, okay, I'm almost there. Maybe like a half an hour more. That optical illusion goes on for hours on the trail and also in the book. And my copy of the book is comically thin, but also the text itself is microscopic. Ugh. So like one page is actually five pages. And that did me in.
I think that this is honestly a pretty fantastic book, but it is bananas.
This morning, I was thinking about what Agatha Christie had to do to create this plot, especially coming at this as a writer who also tries to create complex plots. I almost started crying because I was so overwhelmed by how skilled you would have to be to create such a complex web of information.
I don't want to be weird about this, but there's no reason that it has to be this complicated, which I think says a lot about her, Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable accomplishment.
One thing I think we did get right in the pre-read is we talked about this as like kind of planting her flag in the genre. Mm-hmm. This is my third book. I feel like it's like, yes, I belong here. Look at what I can do.
Oh, yeah. This is very much a separation. Where she is like, this is the way I write a mystery novel. So stop saying that Poirot is Sherlock Holmes and Hastings is, you know, Watson.
Okay. Chad.
Yes.
Would you like to share with us the crime, who did it, and what their motive was?
Of course. Yes. Caitlin, this is the time. Also, again, I know we said it, but this is going to give away everything in the book right now. So just if you haven't read it yet, this is the time to stop. Okay. The main victim is Paul Renault, whose name is actually George Cunno. The murderer is Marta Dubray. The motive is money. The Renault family fortune. Also, we should also mention that there is a second body, though.
Maybe a fatality, we would call it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a fatality. There is a person who is somewhat of a drifter who dies of natural causes, who then is also stabbed.
So, his body is used as a prop.
Yes.
In a big, long con. And that's where I think it gets to the fact that, like, maybe someone could suspect Marth. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could suspect her of having interest in Jack and his money. But in no way could they factor in the second body, the subterfuge, the many, many loops and twirls that this plot does.
Yeah. And yes, and so that is it. Mm-hmm. I think we should move on now.
I think we need to get into it.
So, Caitlin, this will not surprise you, but this book starts on a train in France, and Hastings meets a young woman who he, the first line of this book is really interesting and has a history to it. And if you could go into it, that would be amazing.
Absolutely. And I also want to say, I think the thing that's so funny is that Hastings doesn't realize that he's attracted to her until she starts paying attention to him. And he's like, oh, you acknowledge my existence? Let's go. So, yeah. So it's interesting because like the first line of this book is like kind of a cultural reference and now is like a deep cut. But then I think everybody would know what it meant. So I think she was, her audience would be fine with this. But I was like, what is happening? Okay, so it starts.
I believe that a well-known anecdote exists to the effect that a young writer, determined to make the commencement of his story forcible and original enough to catch and rivet the attention of the most blasé editors, penned the following sentence. "Hell," said the Duchess.
So I'm going to start with saying, like, even reading it out loud, that's quite a start.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a topsy-turvy little sentence. but the line, "Hell," said the Duchess, and I think the full line is, "Hell," said the Duchess as she lit her cigar, is kind of like a literary joke. It's almost like an urban legend, but for writers, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the general thing is a young boy or a writer or an editor, kind of depending on who's telling the story, tries to startle their readers with the first line, "Hell," said the Duchess as she lit her cigar, because duchesses were supposed to like act and be a certain proper way. Saying the word "hell" and then lighting a cigar is like the most scandalous way to start. So this writer or editor was trying to surprise the audience by putting that first. She's trying to tell us that she's starting with a bang. You know, she's like, I'm going to have a scandalous lady right away, and I'm going to be edgy and like, look at me. There is a payoff where the last scene of the book also references this. And I think it's important because had we not had that return to this moment, it would have been such a stupid place to start. She could have really just started with the next line that is like, the Calais Express was singularly empty. Okay, we're like in a scene. We don't have to do this weird reference. But this woman who we'll now know as Cinderella, who is Hastings' future wife, begins by shouting the word "hell." And that gets his attention. He's like, who is this lady swearing in my train car? That's really what we're starting with.
It's a really interesting way of starting the book, where we're starting in Hastings' brain with something that has nothing to do with anything really. But then he's like, oh, this kind of reminded me of this.
Yeah.
I was a little stunned at how much chemistry the two of them have in this scene. And it was really weird because after reading Styles, which was just Hastings striking out left and right and having unrequited feelings for Mary Cavendish, now he's with someone who's flirting with him.
The tone of their flirting is so masterful. This is not the love story that Hastings thought he would get. Yes, she's a woman. Yes, she's talking to him. So automatically, check, check. She's marriage material, but she clearly comes from like a different class and is not his idea of what a woman should be. She says "hell," and he's like, like I don't know what I think of her. And he says, a woman I consider should be womanly. I have no patience with the modern neurotic girl who jazzes from morning to night, smokes like a chimney, and uses language that would make a Billingsgate fishwoman blush. And I think I'm so glad that Hastings doesn't get a really bland girl who will just agree with him. He's given this like formidable woman with a crazy past. She's just so much more capable than he will ever be.
I mean, she saves someone's life, which is more than Hastings has ever done. This gets to our point about Hastings having the memory of a goldfish, because this woman is the antithesis of Mary Cavendish. Mm-hmm. Cinderella is. Mary Cavendish, from a well-to-do family, very mannered, also a really good character. But Cinderella is this performer.
She ends up calling him out on his own classist assumptions. So she's like, I can see how much you disapprove of me and screw you, basically.
Yeah, she also is completely onto him right away. In a lot of ways, she is as far ahead of him as Poirot is.
Oh my God. Of course, the person Hastings falls in love with is on a Poirot level of being able to read him. Of course, that's who his love interest will ultimately be. And that Poirot ultimately approves of, too. Hastings is destined to, like, wander through the world oblivious with exceptionally capable people. Right. And he calls her a mixture of child and woman.
A couple of times he does, yeah.
She's maybe 17. Hastings has to be in his late 30s now.
I think so, yeah. Because I think we had him at 35 in the first book, right?
Yeah. We also, in this scene, we get some interesting setups. We learn now that Hastings is working for an MP. It's almost like he's working for a senator, right?
Yeah, a congressperson, a senator, a parliamentarian. Yeah. Right. And because in the US, for me, MP always means military personnel.
Yeah. The function of all of this is to kind of orient us to where we are, but introduce Cinderella, who will become important. It's interesting that they end up connecting by reminiscing about the Styles case. You know, he mentions I live with Poirot, and she's like, oh yeah, it was that case. Hastings actually goes into like a couple paragraphs of reflecting on the Styles case and his time with Poirot.
He even describes her as like paying like rapt attention to it, which gives you that feeling of how famous Poirot is now. Mm-hmm. Even though she's so modern, she still cares and like is paying a lot of attention to him recanting Styles.
She then confesses, oh, I know about Poirot. She says, quote, I just adore crime. When there's a murder on, I just devour the papers. We know that Agatha Christie loves to put fairy tales, loves to overlay, sometimes sloppily, some like myths into her stories. Here we get the intriguing woman, and then she disappears into the night. And Hastings is the equivalent of the prince then going on this like search for her.
Exactly. The prince who lives with a detective. Also, when we see Cinderella later, he would basically think that England and France are these tiny little countries where like five people live and you could just bump into the same person over and over again.
There is an invisible magnetism between all of our characters that is drawing them into each other's orbit. We have to accept that. The mechanics of this universe, fantastic. God, should we go to chapter two?
Okay, so we're going on to chapter two here, and chapter two is called An Appeal for Help. This is where we see that Poirot and Hastings are flatmates. They live together in a flat in London. Poirot has become a very famous detective, private investigator. They kind of have this lovely little rapport. You know, Hastings is asking about if there are any cases, anything important, and we get this really quaint feeling for the time where you would just write a letter to Poirot. And he would open it and go, yes, I'll take this case. It's really cool. And keeping in mind that at this point in time that Hastings has just come back from France.
Yes.
Then Poirot gets a letter and reads it. And it's from Paul Renault, who is stating that he is in danger and he needs the detective's help. And it's like this appeal for help. And then they decide to go back to France.
Immediately.
Immediately. So chapter one is the introduction of Cinderella to the story. And that's why that's there, because they could have just started in the flat.
As soon as Hastings comes home, there's this famous line. Poirot is like, pardon, but your tie is not symmetrical. Permit that I rearrange him. Because, of course, he speaks French and ties have gender. Hastings comes home and we get his little description of what Poirot looks like and what his mentality is. He describes him as an extraordinary little man, height 5'4", egg-shaped head carried a little to one side, eyes that shone green when he was excited, stiff military mustache, air of dignity immense. He was neat and dandified in appearance. For neatness of any kind, he had an absolute passion. To see an ornament set crookedly, or a speck of dust, or a slight disarray in one's attire was torture to the little man, until he could ease his feelings by remedying the matter. Order and method were his gods.
Oh, so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of the order that we've done this, I found it to be fascinating to see this Poirot in sharp contrast to Halloween Party Poirot.
God, yeah.
Who seems like, even though he is energetic compared to a lot of the older people he's talking to during Halloween Party, his friends who are just like, terrible. Mm-hmm. But he does seem tired in that book.
Yeah.
He seems weary. And it's just, and the repetition of just how the world is being so terrible mm-hmm. in the 60s and all that stuff. It's so great to see him in this place where he's not this young, spry dude, but he's like at the top of his game. Mm-hmm. He's just started his investigation and he's got all this energy and he's fixing people's ties and he's just got all, yeah, I love yeah. it. Yeah,
this moment where he gets the letter and he's like, absolutely, we're going to Calais. No questions asked. His eyes shine green. He's like, Hastings, turn around. We're going back to France.
We also have, there are a couple of things that happen with the letter that
we need to explain.
One of the things that is in the letter is that when Hastings and Poirot get on the ferry and go to France, that there will be a car waiting for them.
That's important. Yeah.
And that's important. And then the second thing is that we have the mention of the, I believe it's a South American town
yeah.
called Santiago.
In Chile. Yeah.
In Chile. Yeah.
The letter says, I need you to come to France, but you may have to go Chile. You may have to go to South America because there's something about like a secret and maybe Poirot needs to go there to like figure it out. Hastings is like, oh my God, this is so exciting. Maybe we get to work for this famous millionaire that has his business in like South America. I'm so excited.
What a day for Hastings.
Yeah.
He meets this very attractive young woman. And then this opportunity happens where he has to go back to France. What a life, right? Like just incredible.
They're on the ferry and he's explaining to Hastings that even though there's that invitation to go to South America, he's like, I won't need to go to South America because my brain can figure everything out from here. And this is where we get like the fox and the hound, or the fox and the hunter analogy. Yes. And I think we need to know that. So what he kind of describes is that there are certain kinds of detectives. One is the fox that like sniffs around on the ground for clues. And the other one is the hunter that just waits sitting on the horse for the clues to come to them. So he's just kind of saying like, let the foolish detectives gather these so-called clues. They can bring them to me and I'm going to work it out. But there's no way I need to demean myself by evidence gathering.
Yeah, and I think there's also a psychological bent to what he's saying where, and we see this at Styles and we see this in this book and also Halloween Party, which is that the big mistakes that the other investigators make, they don't take the time to understand the psychology yeah. of the situation. I think Poirot is saying anyone can make what they want of clues, but you don't understand what they mean until you understand what's happening.
He taps his forehead and he's like, my work is done from within here, which I think is so sweet. Mm-hmm. So he's really establishing that on this ferry ride, on this mode of transportation, and we will get many. So as you say, they get to Calais and there's no car to meet them. And they're like, okay, this is weird. Poirot's like, oh shit, this is going to be troublesome. This will not be easy to work out. Things are already wrong. So they hire a car. And then, Chad, tell us what happens when we enter Merlinville-sur-Mer, this like imaginary French seaside town. There's a beach, there's hotels, there's tourists. What do they stumble upon as they're going to the house?
Hastings sees this woman who comes out of a house to give them instructions on how to get to Renault's mm-hmm. house. And he says, or he thinks, I am an admirer of beauty, and here was one whom nobody could have passed without remark. Very tall, with the proportions of a young goddess, her uncovered golden head gleaming in the sunlight. I swore to myself that she was one of the most beautiful girls I had ever seen. 6 hours after I had just seen the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. Yeah, it's bananas.
My favorite thing here is that, like, because Poirot is just so onto him, and they've been, they're roommates now, he's like, I'm onto you. I imagine he's rolling his eyes and he says, ça commence, which means it starts. You have already seen a goddess. He's like, well, of course.
Right, like within, yeah. 10 minutes of being in France. Yeah, great. Of course, you've already spotted another. Yeah. Well, do we want to go into the doubles thing now?
Yes. Poirot warns Hastings, "Mon ami, two people rarely see the same things. You, for instance, saw a goddess. I saw a girl with anxious eyes." And so things are not as they seem. When we see something, there may be a double of it, or there may be a reflection that's different, just as she did with both Styles and Halloween Party. Agatha Christie is serving us the criminal on a platter. She's like, here she is. She's not what she seems. Yep. Here you go. Now let me do 25 acrobatic plot things, but ultimately we're going to come back to the fact that it's her and that Poirot realized something was wrong because she looked anxious.
Anxious could mean so many things. And so while I was reading the book, getting further into it, it's very hard to think of the girl with anxious eyes as being the murderer, because she could also just be worried. She could know more than she's telling, but that doesn't mean that she killed the people.
With that, they drive to the house, which is Villa Genevieve, right?
Yes, yes.
The first of two houses. We don't have just one. And they, you know, get to the door. They see that there's a police officer there. And they're like, hey, Monsieur Renault sent us. We're here to see him. And the officer goes, well, you can't see him. Monsieur Renault was murdered this morning. Dun, dun, dun. I bow down to this book, even though I am also cranky with it. She has so many good cliffhanger ending of chapters. That's what really gets me. And then I think by the end, it's kind of hard to keep that going. For the first maybe two thirds, it is just like pulling you into the next chapter because you're like, wait, what? And we're just going to get some amazing ones. And I want to just, whenever it happens, pause and acknowledge how awesome it is. So this is the first of many. Oh God. Okay. I think we can go to chapter three.
Which takes place at the Via Genevieve, I believe. This is where we see the scene of the crime. We meet the investigators who are, a couple of the investigators that are there. We meet some of the staff that works at the house, at the giant mansion. Something is introduced here, which is one of my favorite recurring devices. A character who has been through something emotional or physical, and then we are told that that's why they can't be spoken to for a little while.
Yeah.
And it's great that every time that happens, that time frame is integral to the plot.
Yeah.
It builds to eventually the investigators talking to the wife of the murder victim, Mademoiselle Renault. But we have to build to her. We don't just all of a sudden see her first.
There are going to be two kind of officials from the French police that honestly I think could have been one person. We get Monsieur Lucien Bex. Poirot knows him from a time in 1909 in Belgium. So again, we get that kind of reminds me of when we had the police officer from his past in Halloween Party. There's always like someone who is kind of on his side, who's like, this guy is quirky, but trust him because I know. Then we have Monsieur Hoté, who is the juge d'instruction. France has this different role where like a judge is in charge of investigating a crime as opposed to like a detective. They have detectives too. They can both kind of be in there in the investigation and also provide advice about prosecution. And there's something kind of interesting when Poirot and Hastings roll up and they're like, well, we're here to see Monsieur Renault, but he's dead. Poirot says he foresaw his own murder. We get some background about the night of the crime that I think is important. This is the setting the scene, and Hoté provides that. He says that a servant named Françoise found a front door ajar that morning. Nobody had found the body yet. And she's like, that's weird. Then another young maid. Why do we need three house staff? I do not know.
I do not know.
Yeah. The young maid named Léonie finds Madame Renault tied up in her bedroom. She's like, oh, let's go get dressed. Madame Renault is tied in her bedroom. Her wrists are bound and she's gagged and she is in distress. Somebody, I forget who, finds Monsieur Renault's body, someone kind of on the grounds, I think, because there is a golf links in their backyard. We have two big manors, right? We have Villa Genevieve and then Villa, is it Marguerite?
I believe so, yes.
The way I imagine it is like their boundaries are like on the side and there's like some shrubbery that becomes very important. There's so much happens in the shrubbery here that is like in between their houses, but it's thin. So you can kind of overhear what's going on in each backyard. And then behind both of those is a newly created golf course that's still under construction. So someone working on the golf course is like, oh my God, I found Monsieur Renaud's body. He's been found stabbed in the back. Spooky, spooky. He was found stabbed in the back, face down in a freshly dug grave.
Yeah.
Which is like, whoa. And that's actually where I think it's notable to pause and say, this is taking place in a seaside resort. It's sunny. It's lovely outside. There is water glistening off the waves. There are like little cafes. And all of this that's happening is really, really grisly if you think about it too hard. There's so much tension between the setting of where they are, even the way they're like moving about the setting, going off and having like a little luncheon and things. And then just like there's so many bodies festering in the sun.
Just beneath all the beauty, there's this ugliness.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's like that scene in Blue Velvet, you know, where it goes in on the ear.
Yes.
No one mentions the flies. There have to be just so many bugs.
Oh, yeah.
And we just don't mention that.
Right.
Once Madame Renaud is like freed from her bonds, she says, two masked men broke in. They tied her up, took away her husband. And immediately, did you at this point think this is fishy?
Yes, I did. The investigator says something about those are too many beards.
Oh my God, yes.
Both of the men are wearing, they have huge, like a lot of facial hair. And so immediately suspicion is cast upon her story.
Oh, there's too many beards in this story, which is such a great line. But just like you had mentioned, Chad, she's on a sedative. So their discussion with her is delayed. And then we learn about all the different cast of characters in the household. And I think it is important to like slow down and say who they are. So we have Denise, who is Leonie's sister. So we have two young servants, in addition to Francoise, who's like the older one. Then we have a chauffeur who's British, who happens to be on vacation.
Which is interesting, right? Because there was no car sent for Poirot and Hastings.
And I'm so glad you're bringing that up. There is so much misalignment of facts. We almost like cannot not talk about all the weird little details, because then they get kind of strung up and then we have to unravel them all. Mm-hmm. And I think on the first read, I was experiencing that where I was so overwhelmed by all the finicky details, and it does matter.
Yes.
It just does. So then we have someone else who is not present, which is Monsieur and Madame Renaud's son, Jack. He's not at the house. Then we get Francoise. She's interviewed, right?
Yes.
And she kind of goes into this thing about how she locked the front door at 10:30. Monsieur Renaud was the only one awake. So like, that's weird that the door was unlocked in the morning and open. And Monsieur Horté is like, well, wouldn't Monsieur Renaud open it? And she's like, no, he's not that dumb. That's what kind of she says.
Yeah.
Why would he invite burglars? Like, he's smarter than that. And then she says, unless it was for sit dumb, which means like, unless it was for that lady. And they're all like, well, what lady? And she's like, well, there's this lady who visits them all the time. And they press her and she says, well, our neighbor who lives next door, the next house over in Villa Marguerite, is this beautiful woman named Madame Dubray. And this is, we don't know at this point, but this is Marthe's, the goddess, the girl with the anxious eyes. This is her mother.
Yes.
So they're kind of like, oh, a woman visiting. Is Monsieur Renaud having an affair because she's beautiful?
And it was a pretty bold affair, right? With your next door neighbor and just coming by? Wow, that's gutsy.
And we get to know a little bit about her. She's beautiful. She lives with her daughter. Once she was poor, but now she mysteriously has a lot of money. Then Francois shares that Monsieur Renaud was like kind of suffering or wasting away. And he started to seem like increasingly nervous, which aligns with that letter that he sent to Poirot. The last thing Francois says is that Madame Dubray is bad. She says she is a bad one. And so we're like, oh, okay. We also learned that all the windows were fastened, which Poirot thinks is weird because people should have broken in through, they should have been looking to break in through the windows, not just like walk into the front door, because who does that?
Right.
We talk to Denise, Léonie's sister. Why again? And she says that she confirms a lot of things, but she also says that a younger woman was there that night. She'd never seen her before, and she was possibly English. And she only could catch the last bit of their conversation, which is, "For God's sake, go now." Again, now we have two possible mysterious women. Like, what are they doing? Why are they talking to him? Then we learn that Monsieur Renaud, as you just said, had told the chauffeur he could take a holiday because he wouldn't need the car. And Poirot was like, this is really weird. Poirot's like, can Monsieur Renaud drive? And Francois says no. And so he's like, well, why would he send the chauffeur away, especially if he really needs the chauffeur? And Poirot guesses, kind of at the end of the chapter, the last idea that we're left with is that Monsieur Renaud wanted the chauffeur gone before Poirot arrived.
Why?
Dun, dun, dun.
Something that I think that's important to distinguish and so subtly done in the mysterious affair at Stiles, Hastings is the man. He's the guest. He's helping out with all of the things. And he also knows Poirot, who he then brings onto the case. And Poirot is the outsider, the interloper. Here, we see that Poirot is so well thought of that Hastings gets to be in all of these scenes. If Hastings showed up without Poirot, we would not be getting this story. They admire him so much that they think of Hastings as potentially also being an investigator. It is a completely different power structure than the first book.
There's even some tension about that because Hastings really pushes it. And then feels embarrassed about maybe having gone too far. So that's such a good point. They're outsiders, but in a completely different capacity than they were before. So let's go to chapter 4. I'm so glad we're here. It's called The Letter Signed Bella. And we will say that Bella is Cinderella's twin sister, and they are acrobatic performers.
The person that Cinderella was looking for when she was on the train with Hastings.
Just as a side, this isn't important, but Bex is like, well, we should probably believe Denise more than Françoise because Françoise is old. And so I just want to note that, like, there is a lot of misogyny, especially in this chapter and in this book. As I was reading this, I was like, you know what? It's misogyny, but it just feels cuter than Halloween Party. Like, Halloween Party felt really cruel. And these people are, like, just dumb.
Yeah, it's like, it's this weird just kind of course that's the way that it is, misogyny in this book. Whereas with Halloween Party, it's more like, what is happening? What
it's do you sinister. Hate
women so much? Yeah, yeah, and young girls, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely a different vibe for sure.
So Bex, he announces that they have found a letter written to Monsieur Renaud, and it was in his pocket, right? It was in his jacket pocket. And we'll read you the context, and we'll tell you how they saw it, and then what's really happening. The letter says, "My dearest one, why have you not written for so long? You do love me still, don't you? Your letters lately have been so different, cold, and strange. And now this long silence, it makes me afraid. If you were to stop loving me, but that's impossible. What a silly kid I am, always imagining these things. But if you did stop loving me, I don't know what I would do. Kill myself, perhaps. I couldn't live without you. Sometimes I fancy another woman has come between us. Let her look out, that's all. And you too. I'd soon as kill you as let her have you. I mean it." But then she's like, "But there, I'm writing in high-flown nonsense. You love me and I love you. Yes, love you, love you, love you, your own adoring Bella."
Yeah.
Whoa.
And so when I'm reading that for the first time, I'm falling for everything that Agatha Christie is laying down. Wait a second. So Dobre's name is Bella potentially, like as a nickname? Mm-hmm. Like what's going, because I think we're meant to feel like this letter is potentially proof of the affair between Renaud and Dobre. And it's not. It is something very, very, very different. It's not even a letter to to Paul Renault.
So, okay, so we know that it's for Jack, and we know that Monsieur Renault was using the wrong, or had the wrong coat on. They'd swapped coats by accident. Mm-hmm. And Bella has been in love with Jack, and Marthe has come between them. And Marthe is really the kind of conniving other woman, even though for a really long time it will be seen that Bella is this, like, low-class interloper, as you had said.
So we're learning that Jack Renault, who is the son of the dead person, Paul Renault, because they switched jackets, which we find out later was done in hastiness because of an argument, I believe.
Yes.
Then Renault's body was found with this jacket on, and this letter is in it. And the letter is actually, therefore, in his son's jacket because of the switch up. And so this letter was written to Jack from Bella, who is Cinderella's sister, because yeah. Bella and Jack are having an affair that Paul Renault looks down upon. I guess people look down upon because of the class difference. And then also Jack is having an affair with Marthe Dobray. And so that's where we are. Yeah, uh-huh. That's the other woman. Yeah. So that's just, you know, that's just a little idea of like how simple the story is. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So we get, the letter. But now it complicates things because they're like, well, we have these masked men, but we also have the possibility of a jilted lover. Which one is it going to be? So already we have these like kind of two narratives.
Right.
The bad detectives are going to kind of mash them up. And Poirot's like, no, you can't have masked men.
Right.
So like left and right, people are just making horrible choices. And even further, they're like, okay, well, if a woman killed him, well, stabbing a man in the back is definitely a woman's crime.
Oh, yeah.
But a woman could never, ever dig a grave. It's her little delicate fingers. Like, how could she do that? So literally everyone, including Poirot, is like, well, in terms of the grave digging, there had to be a man involved. Women don't know. They don't even know what a shovel is. Yeah. It's unquestioned by everyone. Like, that never gets countered.
Right.
Of course, this is an Agatha Christie story, so we have to have a will. He's left some of his, like a little bit of money to his secretary, Monsieur Stoner, who's out of town. And the rest is left to his wife, Madame Renault. And so they're like, whoa, okay. That's kind of harsh because he has this son, like, geez.
Yeah, none left to Jack. That's interesting. Hmm.
And so they're like, well, of course, this is really recent. And before, Jack inherited half and Madame Renault inherited half. But 2 weeks ago, the servants, Francoise and Denise, witnessed a change because, God, like, I feel like servants, half of their job is to be witnesses to signing new wills.
I could just see them, too, like, being summoned and both of them being like, oh, God, Christ. Here we go again. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. As of 2 weeks ago, leaving this money to Madame Renault shows that he actually cared a lot about his wife. That doesn't really check with an affair. Then we go into Monsieur Renault's study. And so they're kind of looking for any hints. And I love it because Poirot looks around and he's like, oh, I need something to like clean or straighten. And he sees that everything is really orderly and he gets really disappointed. He's like, oh. There's nothing I can be fussy about. But then he's like, ha-ha, the corner or the hearth rug is crooked. And he straightens it. And when he straightens it, he finds a little tiny slip of ripped paper. It's a fragment of a check. And the name written on it is Duveen. And that's written in Monsieur Renault's handwriting.
We're getting this wonderful juxtaposition between the bad detectives taking things the wrong way and making the wrong assumptions. And then we're seeing Poirot find these things, but he's already like, there's no way that either of these stories are correct.
Yeah.
His mind is wide open to a million different things.
He's like, okay, well, I have to make Hastings do something. So he's like, I'm going to teach him things along the way about like my methods. So yes. He says, the moral of that is always look under the mats. My friend Hastings here will tell you that anything in the least crooked is a torment to me. As soon as I saw that the hearth rug was out of the straight, I said to myself, the legs of the chair caught it in being pushed back. Possibly there may be something underneath which the good Françoise overlooked. So he's like, let me school everyone about why neatness is important. So yes. Little lesson from Poirot. So the last thing that happens is they visit the body, which this is also like, just what is happening?
So yes, so they've been inside going through all these clues and then they go see the body. That's fantastic.
Yeah, they've taken the body from the golf links, from the grave. They put it in a hot, 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 hot shed. And they put a sheet over it. So mm-hmm. in terms of like crime scene techniques, I feel like forensics people would be just like, they're just dying now. Like they're breaking out in hives.
Right. I think it's probably like how people who work at internet security would feel about two people keeping their passwords on a Google document.
What? Who would do that? I don't know. We get like a little bit of a character description of Monsieur Renault. He's tan because he's lived in South America in the sun. And creepily, he has this like huge look of terror on his face. So they look at the murder weapon. It's a little knife. It's like a little commemorative paper knife, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Poirot's like, oh, it doesn't have fingerprints. But because murder and true crime is so popular in the news, everyone knows about fingerprints. About the body, the thing that's kind of weird is that he's in his pajamas and he's wearing an overcoat. Why would two masked men not kill him in his house, take right. him out of his house, but put a coat on, but they're not going very far?
None of it is adding up in Poirot's mind at all.
And so lastly, Poirot, he's like looking at everything and he's like, oh, that jacket is it's too long for him. And, you know, of course, we know now it was the wrong jacket. But Hastings is like, oh, Poirot, that is such an inappropriate remark to make over this horribly treated dead body.
Right, exactly. Show some respect to this corpse that's been sitting out and will be for the next 3 days.
God, that's just kind of treated like a potted plant. They're like, oh, come see this. Okay, so Chad.
Yes.
You and I have been talking for many, many minutes now. And I think what we have realized is that this book is so gorgeously complex, we don't want to rush through it.
Correct. Yes, I agree. Yes.
So we're at an interesting juncture where for the first time in this podcast, we are maybe looking at like a multi-part series.
I don't think there is any way to sum up The Murder on the Links in one episode. And I don't think it's even possible to do in two.
Yeah.
So I think we just do like a multi-part debrief.
I think we're going to pause and pick back up
with chapter 5.
Thank you so much for staying with us. We're so happy you're here. We can't wait to see you in the next episode.
I'm just so excited to spend another episode in France. This is great.